Well, welcome. Welcome to the this book launch under the auspices of the Hellenic Observatory and the European Institute. And you can see that there are a range of upcoming events here and elsewhere. But today we're going to be talking about the launch of, talking about this book, launch of an exciting book by two people who are probably known to you, but I'm going to introduce them all the same. Professor Dimitris Papadimitriou, Professor of Politics, Director of the Manchester Jean Monnet Centre of Excellence. Dimitris's work is in the area of contemporary Greek politics and the European Union's relationship with Eastern Europe. He's got a very long-standing connection with the LSE, having been a research fellow in the European Institute, later a visiting fellow and a National Bank of Greece senior research fellow in the Hellenic Observatory. And he worked at the Universities of Bradford and Leeds and has been a visiting fellow at Yale and Princeton. Along with Kevin Featherston, he's published The Last Ottomans, Muslim Minority of Greece, and the Limits of Europeanization. He's written on his own, Romania on the European Union, or actually with David Finnemore, Negotiating a New Europe, Ashgate, so a large number of published works here, books, and a large number of articles in some of our major journals. Kevin Featherston is also a professor of contemporary Greek studies and professor of European politics here. His research interests cover the European Union and European politics. Director of the Hellenic Observatory, position I think you've held since 2002. Co-chair of LSE research on the Southeastern Europe within the European Institute, and before academic posts, before the post here, sorry, he held academic posts at Stirling and Bradford, where I think we first met.
Yes, indeed.
He's held visiting positions in the University of Minnesota, New York, Harvard University, and served on an advisory committee for the reform of the Greek government, which will obviously stand him in good stead when talking about today's topic. His books include the classic Road to Maastricht with Ken Dyson, United States and the European Community in the 1990s, and Socialist Parties and European Integration and Comparative History. And today they're going to be talking about this new book based on some pretty extensive research, a large number of interviews of the people who are involved in it, in how the Greek prime ministers organize themselves and conduct their politics and policy making. I think there's going to be around about 40, 45 minutes of introducing the main themes, after which we will take questions on the floor.
Thanks, Ed.
Well, thanks, Ed, for that introduction. The sequence for this evening is that I'm going to start off. I'm then going to pass over to Dimitris, and then I'll come back and conclude with some further thoughts. I'm tempted to thank the Hellenic Observatory for inviting me to come and give this talk, but I'll simply pass on that one. We are here to talk about the new book which we've written, Prime Ministers in Greece, The Paradox of Power. So in that sense, the book is, we think, concerned with a big question. How can a prime minister establish an effective system for the control and coordination of the government in order to better achieve his or her objectives? And beyond the control and coordination of the government, we might add to that other criteria, the ability to plan strategically, policy evaluation, impact assessments. Those kind of things are more contemporarily the kind of criteria that we would expect to be judged in relation to the centre of government or the apex of government, the Prime Minister and the Prime Minister's office. But of course, in these respects, these questions of the ability to manage the organisation are essentially generic issues, generic questions which would be faced by the leaders of any large organization, anywhere in any political system. But our book addresses these questions, of course, in one particular case, Greece, it happens to be highly topical, not least in terms of the ability of the government to deliver reform. Very often, we hear comments outside Greece to the effect of, why doesn't Greece reform? Why doesn't Greece put its own house in order? Now, of course, there's an implicit assumption here, perhaps, that Greece was primarily responsible for getting into the crisis, and it has the means of getting out of the crisis and managing its own recovery. That's quite an assumption to make. But I'm going to put that issue to one side and say, nevertheless, our focus in terms of the management of the government does have some relationship to the bigger topic of the ability to reform, the ability to implement reforms. The reform capacity of Greece has obviously been an issue which social scientists have considered for a number of years. Even before the crisis, Dimitris Papadimitriou and I published a book entitled, as Ed has signaled, The Limits of Europeanization, in which we tried to take a political economy approach to look at reform in key areas in Greece, pensions, labor market reform, privatization, and to look at the interaction between government, unions, and employers in the Greek context, and to try to assess the constraints on reform and the implementation of reform. Now, we concluded from that despite the impetus for reform from the European Union, reform domestically was structurally constrained by a skewed system of corporatism. Some have called it a disjointed system of corporatism between unions, business, and government, an embedded statism in the economy and rent-seeking behavior, barriers to a largely liberal economic agenda being promoted by the European Union even before the current crisis. But in this book, we now turn the focus to government itself and to look inside governments, to look inside the government machine as a factor in itself affecting the capacity for reform. And it quickly seemed to us that government in Greece is based on something of a paradox that stems from the very top. In constitutional terms, a Greek prime minister is one of the most powerful heads to be found anywhere in Europe. But in practice, we argue, the operational powers of a Greek prime minister and the resources available to the prime minister for key functions like coordination and control are very limited indeed. So, in another paper, we use the cliched expression of the Prime Minister being an emperor without clothes. That is, in constitutional terms, very strong, but when you look at the reality, actually rather limited and constrained. Now, the book covers an historical spectrum. We cover the period from 1974, the restoration of democracy, through successive prime ministerships, premierships. We look in particular at five prime ministerial periods. And we've gathered, I think, quite a large amount of empirical evidence. And when eventually I stop making this introduction, I'm going to pass to Dimitris to give you more of the empirical analysis of the individual cases. But let me try to signal at this stage what our essential argument is. The argument is that despite, over time, changes of personality, of political party, of programs, the ability of the Prime Minister and his staff to control and coordinate the government machine has remained severely limited. And the capacity to perform other tasks impact assessments, policy evaluations, strategic planning, has indeed been minimal. And the position of the Prime Minister reflects these dysfunctionalities. Of course, there's been variation across time. Different Prime Ministers have had relatively more or relatively less staffing resources around them. Different personalities have brought a different approach to the management of the government. But this is like some kind of fluctuation within narrow bands, rather like a snake in the tunnel, as it were, if this was diagrammatically represented. The point is, fluctuation over time has been confined. No Prime Minister has brought about transformative or lasting change in the efficient and effective management of the government machine. It's been variations on a theme, and there is a theme here of a path dependency. So our conceptual frame has been geared to try to explain the absence of transformation, the absence of substantive change. Why hasn't it occurred? In political science terms, this path dependency, of course, links very much with a historical institutionalist perspective. But within that, we also give a very strong emphasis to cultural factors that seem to stand against major lasting change. In other words, we argue there are cultural norms and habits, instincts, that create predispositions in the way that government is run from the top. But let me begin by talking of some of the institutional realities before coming to talk about some of the cultural attitudes which might constrain change and have an impact on the ability to manage the government. The first point I would emphasize is that a good prime minister sits at the center of a vast archipelago of separate ministries, separate public bodies of different types. In other words, government in Athens is within silos, within compartments. We think of a sprawling governmental structure, and we think of the recent example of the issue of whether the government could know who was employed by the government, how many people were employed, and where they were employed across the government's archipelago. The point is of the archipelago is that coordination across ministries, across public bodies, is hugely problematic. And seen within a comparative European perspective, this problem of coordination is exacerbated by the weakness of the cabinet system in itself. In many instances, the cabinet system could be seen as a mechanism for coordination, a mechanism for joined-up government. But within the Greek case, the cabinet system is limited and fragile. For most of the post-1974 period, the cabinet system, the cabinet, the full cabinet, has met infrequently. And when it does, it's big news. And it can be an occasion when the Prime Minister is televised speaking to his ministers, rather like a medieval king and a medieval court. Often, no minutes are taken of cabinet meetings. If the minutes are taken, they're for the Prime Minister's eyes only, not to be circulated. And beneath that full cabinet, the rest of the structure of what might be found in terms of cabinet committees, interdepartmental committees, in the Greek case, is extremely limited or non-existent. In other words, the linking committees between ministries, which might be found in London or Paris or many smaller European democracies, have been almost entirely absent. So in other words, in terms of the cabinet system, what is embedded in the system institutionally is very limited, and the operation of the cabinet depends very much on the whims or the preferences of an individual prime minister. As I say, Dimitris will talk about more of the individual cases in a little while, but I want to come back to the theme of fragmentation, institutional fragmentation of government. Itself facilitates ministers protecting their own political interests in separate spaces of the organisational structure. Silos and compartments allow ministers to protect their own political interests. Some, of course, are able to develop what we might refer to in medieval terms, again, as fiefdoms, their own clientelistic networks distributing favours to their supporters. In any event, ministers can exploit these spaces, ministers can exploit their isolation in order to resist themselves having to implement unpopular reforms, reforms that might damage their own personal political standing. So we have an archipelago, we have a weak cabinet system. Let's add to that a problem of legal confusion across the system. The Greek notion of polynomy, too many laws, nicely highlights the problem of the complexity and the contradiction between legislation. With any new particular law, governments may not know, the system may not know, what other laws currently exist which potentially contradict the new legislation. Provisions may be hidden in laws with entirely different titles, laws concerned with entirely different subjects, but which contain some small provision which impacts on the new legal initiative. And the government machine doesn't have the capacity to readily cross-check that kind of thing. So we have, again, a further problem in the inability to coordinate as a result of the massive legislation which may be self-contradictory, and the government machine doesn't have the capacity to clarify potential contradictions. There's not only a shallowness of expertise, but also a discontinuity of personnel. So we think of the arrival of a new prime minister bringing an entire new set of staff. It's almost a cliched example, but when Kostas Tsimitis, as prime minister, entered the prime minister's residence of Maximou in 1996, he met just two people remaining in the prime minister's office. One was a typist and the other was a gardener. A total discontinuity. And of course, Kostas Tsimitis was taking over from a prime minister within his own political party. This wasn't them, this was just another us, as it were. Now, in fairness, we can say that subsequent prime ministers, like Kostas Karamanlis and George Papandreou, could easily tell similar stories. When George Papandreou became prime minister, the story was that the previous government had ripped out all of the computers and the hard drives from the computers in the prime minister's office, and they had to wait 2 weeks before getting computers up and running within the prime minister's office. It's indicative of the discontinuity of knowledge and of personnel, the disruption to the coordination of government at the centre. And the deeper point then is precisely the discontinuity. The system struggles to know what went before, let alone to learn from what went before. Much has to be created again ab initio, or improvised, as it were. The system lacks the continuity of knowledge. And alongside this structural differentiation of governments, alongside the problems of the archipelago, is an administrative culture that is the very opposite of being responsive or being able to adapt pragmatically. We can talk about there being a legal formalism in how public administration operates in Greece. anyone who's had the pleasure of dealing with public administration in Greece can tell 27 different stories about the rigidity, the unresponsiveness, the over-procedural regulations, and in other words, the lack of adaptation, the lack of flexibility, the rigidness of procedures. But certainly the administration is also strongly hierarchical. We can think of what some have described as the tyranny of requiring the minister's signature for even the most minor public decisions. The appointment of a new professor, not a modest event, of course, but the appointment of a new professor in a university cannot happen without the signature of the Minister of Education. One wonders why. But it certainly indicates the rigidity, the hierarchical nature of governments. Many governments in Europe are hierarchical. We think of Napoleonic legacies and traditions. But this isn't the efficiency of a Napoleonic system found in Paris or wherever. Ministers may pull levers in the machine and not have any confidence in how the machine is going to respond. There is no grand corps of public servants in the Greek case. And the efficiency of the machine, as vindicated, is undermined by the shortage or the misallocation of skills and technology. So in an institutional sense, the institutional perspective would be to say that effective control and coordination of the government from the top is undermined by this institutional fragmentation, the legal confusion, and the administrative weaknesses in the public sector. As a result, effective action, effective reform initiatives require the political leadership to get round or circumvent the formal processes. We can cite the example of the 2004 Olympic Games in Greece, where the Prime Minister's office, Kostas Tsimitis as Prime Minister, had to send out motorcyclists across different ministries in Athens to gather signatures for official documents, because those signatures were necessary for the legal formalism that applies. But the only way to do it quickly and effectively was just to send out motorcyclists through the traffic system of Athens to try to get the agreements in place. In other words, to get things done, because of the rigidities of the system, because of the weaknesses of the administrative machine, people must develop their own personal networks, the ways of channels of finding their way around the road blockages. So this is a rough sketch, a brief sketch of the organizational structures and the operational problems surrounding a prime minister. But we can go deeper than this. It's not just organizational structures. We can look at attitudes, behaviors, expectations, mental frames in the social and cultural setting. Indeed, I think a social anthropologist could do great work in terms of penetrating the government institutions and how government institutions operate, giving a better sense, a much better sense, of the cultural attitudes, the social norms, the habits, the instincts, which create barriers to change and maintain a sense of the way of doing things here. Not only is the Prime Minister and his staff organizationally detached, they also sustain a set of social norms, mindsets, and assumptions of their own separation from the rest of government. And one of the social values, one of the norms which affects this capacity for management is the norm of personal trust. Personal trust, hugely important. The Prime Minister's entourage typically displays an absence of trust in the wider government machine. A lack of trust, that is, in the loyalty, the skills, and the processes of the wider public administration. The mental frame, the cultural perspective itself, prompts an insularity and a smallness around the Prime Minister. All of this would be reminiscent to those of you who've studied certain courses in political science of a classic work of French bureaucracy written in the 1960s by Michel Crozier, where he talked about omnipotent formal power being undermined by the feelings of a lack of trust up and down the bureaucratic hierarchy, and the impersonal rules, the centralization, isolation, and the circumvention in the bureaucratic system. Let me try to show you one quote. Interview with the previous Prime Minister. We said in the interview, you have, in this interview, recognised the impediments, the barriers, the inefficiencies, the rigidities to the effective coordination and management of the government. But in your entire period as Prime Minister, you never had more than about 12 or 14 personal advisers. How come your diagnosis doesn't fit with the solution you had? 12 or 14 staff is minuscule in European terms. His immediate response was to say, if you gave me more advisors, I wouldn't know what to do with them. Why wouldn't you know what to do with them? I can't see more than 12 or 14 advisors in any one week. Why do you need to see them? If I don't see them, how could I trust them? He came back. Well, I said, the head of Ford or IBM, major companies, tend to get by on the basis of systems of organizational structure, of hierarchy, without the head of the organization having to see personally on a weekly basis each of their senior staff. Ah, he said, this is Greece. It doesn't operate like that. If I had more staff, everything I said would be in the newspapers tomorrow morning. I couldn't trust such a wider circle. It emphasizes the importance of trust. But it also, I guess, reflects two truths, two valid interpretations. Interpretation number one, as a foreigner, I was sensitive to the fact that large organizations often have more staff available to the leader, and there are systems for advice and coordination which go beyond the question of regularly seeing people. Within the context, he had his own truth, as it were, to say that the Prime Minister feels that he must be protected, and the way of protection is to have a small staff, a cell, an enclosed group. It's us versus them, or it's us in the wider context of not being able to trust them, they, in the rest of the public administration. It's an attitude which is detached. It's a mindset that self-limits, and the mindset has consequences. The distrust and detachment at the top of government contributes to the shallowness, the limitations of control and coordination across the wider machine. And this shallowness, or this minimalism, is itself culturally shaped by sets of attitudes. Now, of course, the ways of doing politics in Greece, so please.
So, I think we need to
hurry up. Yes, okay, good, thank you. I've got just a little bit more, thank you. The Hellenic Observatory is very strict with these things. One final thing to mention by way of introduction, and that is, of course, the way of doing politics in the Greek case has an additional dimension. Clientelism places expectations on the leader to deliver favours. Institutions lack loyalty, political favours are a substitute. Let's show you one other quote. Oh, that's the same quote. Let me. Yeah. Well, why does that
happen? It's the right title.
Okay. Indeed, yes. Now, I was wondering how long it would take you to find that solution. One minister talking about another prime minister. As prime minister, he spent much of his time pursuing favours, respectively. He would often phone a minister and ask for favours. He would even call my deputy, that is the deputy minister, and ask him to do such things behind my back. I wished he would focus on the big picture, but he couldn't leave his telephone alone. It's the politics of clientelism and the impact on leadership and the approach of running government. In other words, what I'm suggesting is that the wider clientelistic atmosphere is something which is not unique to governments, but links society and government together. It is reciprocal. Social attitudes in wider society and attitudes within government connect with each other. Let me just speed up on this particular point. So we describe a variation on a theme. It's the lack of substantive change. And that is a crucial introductory point. The individual prime ministers have rearranged their offices, sometimes having more staff or less staff. They come with different personalities, different perspectives on management. Still, none has produced effective and lasting change in the ability of the Prime Minister to control, to manage, to coordinate. This limited functionality, of course, does have implications for the theme I started off with in terms of reform capacity. So I will now pass over to my co-author, Dimitrios Papadimitriou, to examine in more detail the five cases of the five premierships that we look at in the book. Thanks very much.
Right. So thanks very much for coming. From what has already been said, you'll probably figure out that me and Kevin have been working together for too long. We stopped paying attention to each other a long time ago. Having the opportunity to debate some of these themes with a wider audience, it's really refreshing, and thanks for taking the time to come here. I'm going to skip some of the introductory points I wanted to make that relate more to the problems of data collection in Greece, just to speed up a little bit, but I would like to say a few words about the purpose of the book. And the purpose of the book, of course, is not to engage in some sort of a gossip telling or some sort of a beauty contest in trying to figure out which prime minister did a better job than his predecessor or successor. Of course, judging success, failure, influence, or even nodality within the core executive is a complicated process, and it's always subjective, it is always problematic, and the way in which the government operates, it's only a subset of a wider range of themes that could determine in many ways whether a premiership has been successful or not. So the problem really from the very beginning when we started working on the book was how to devise indicators which will allow us to map out the Greek core executive in a way that would be convincing, we'll find that out today, but also, and quite crucially, would travel to cases beyond Greece, because of course as scholars of Greek politics, we're always paranoid that we don't want to make a comment, a point about the narrow Greek setting, but something that would travel a bit wider. So Don't worry, I'm going to go through it quickly. The way we're trying to do that was to try and focus our work on, if you like, five main pillars of the Greek core executive. One is the prime minister himself. There have always been male prime ministers, unfortunately, as agency, and try and see how different prime ministers scored on that front. To focus on the ministerial council, on the Υπουργικό Συμβούλιο in Greece. Focus on the wider context of the ministerial committees that are there to support the operation of the cabinet. Look at the core executive bureaucracy, of course, and also look at the Prime Minister's office, which forms an important part of this core executive context. So, starting first with the constitutional powers of the Prime Minister, Kevin has already mentioned that. What we find here is that, particularly since the constitutional amendment of 1986, in formal constitutional terms, the Greek Prime Minister is indeed an emperor, right? It is a very, very powerful, powerful figure. Looking at the activism of individual prime ministers, and by that I don't try to make a point about who worked harder than the other. What we're trying to get here into how different prime ministers interpreted the job and therefore trying to exercise it, we see two really different patterns. Karamanlis the senior, Kostas Mitsotakis and Kostas Simitis could be clustered in what you can say were activist prime ministers, people who in very different ways from one another engaged with the detail, were hands-on onto the job and pursue issues even at a level that was sort of beyond the macro picture. Whereas Andreas Papandreou was more detached, certainly more detached during his last premiership in the 1990s, a lot more erratic in the 80s, where he would engage with some issues obsessively, but would completely ignore others. And also Kostas Karamanlis between 2004 and 2009, who saw himself more of a prime minister that was a delegator, right? He did not wish and did not want to be involved in the in the policy detail, and delegated a lot of his a lot of powers to his ministers. In terms of the party strength of individual prime ministers, their position within the party setup, here really all Greek prime ministers since the Metapolitευση have been quite dominant in their own parties. Two possible exceptions, although not significant exceptions. Simitis and Mitsotakis, the two premiers who could claim to have a significant domestic opposition within their own party. Karamanlis, the senior, Papandreou, and Karamanlis, the junior in a different context, were in many ways masters of their own party and did not really face a significant opposition. Moving now to the Ministerial Council, and here trying to find some indicators that will help us to understand how it operated. The first thing to look at is the stability of the Ministerial Council, and that is to say how often prime ministers reshuffle the government. And by that we use a specific, in a way, indicator measuring or accounting as a reshuffle the arrival or the appointment or sacking of at least three ministers on the same day. That's how we define a reshuffle in the Greek context. And what emerges here is that both the all three of the Papandreou premierships and the premiership of Konstantinos Mitsotakis saw a lot of volatility in the membership of the Ministerial Council. If you look at the figure for Papandreou in the 1980s, what would you see there? That on average, Papandreou engaged in nearly a reshuffle every 6 months. And the score by Mitsotakis and Papandreou in the 1990s was not very different. Perhaps Papandreou was a little bit more stable in the 90s, but both Papandreou and Mitsotakis reshuffled the government an awful lot. Compare that with Karamanlis the senior, Simitis, and Karamanlis the junior. Karamanlis the senior would probably reshuffle his government on average once every 2 years, the same figure more or less for Simitis. At Karamanlis, the junior was the most, if you like, averse to reshuffling, changing his ministers or engaging in reshuffles perhaps once every 3 years. So in that sense, the more stable ministerial council of the Metapolitics. Another figure that we've used here is that of ministerial longevity. That's a bit of a complicated indicator. Basically, what we're trying to do here is to try and measure the average ministerial tenures of the five most senior members of the government, according to the government protocol, and compare that to the prime ministerial, to the length of the prime ministerial tenure. The assumption here is that if you have senior ministers who have been around for a long time, that creates the likelihood of a challenge of authority to the prime minister. But the figures here are not particularly exciting. The senior ministers of Karamanlis, the senior, and Papandreou in the 1990s, stayed around for the longest period of time, but that is not really that dissimilar to that of other premierships. So, on average, broadly speaking, the five most senior ministers of the government would stay around for approximately half the length of the prime ministerial tenure in each of the five cases. Another interesting indicator here is the activation of the ministerial council. How often did the ministerial council meet? And that was, in empirical terms, one of the biggest nightmares to figure out, because the government doesn't keep records, or the very few records that exist are not accessible for 30 years. So what we have to do was go back on newspapers every day to try and find, particularly for the 1980s, when did the Ministerial Council meet, and try and come up with some figures. And what you find here is a sharp contrast. On the one hand, Mitsotakis and Simitis activated the Ministerial Council very regularly, normally every second week, so the Ministerial Council would meet nearly 22 times a year, whereas Karamanlis, the senior, Papandreou, and Karamanlis the junior, did not really engage with the Ministerial Council that much. Under Karamanlis, the senior, the Ministerial Council would meet on average every 2 months, under Papandreou, closer to 3 months. Not a regular sort of pattern of meetings. And that's a quite a sharp contrast, which of course mirrors the influence of the Ministerial Council in the government's policy making. Under Mitsotakis and Simitis, the Ministerial Council did become a very central platform for the elaboration of policy, for the resolution of disputes and so on, whereas in the other cases, it did not. And that's an interesting fact in itself, that unlike many other Western European examples, there is no regular pattern of meetings of the Ministerial Council. The Ministerial Council meets when the Prime Minister decides to call it. There is no formal procedure that suggests, like in this country, for example, that the Cabinet meets every so often. When it comes to the level below the Ministerial Council, two areas to look at. One is the inner cabinet, the senior government committee, as it was called, or the government council, the Kybernetiki Epitropi or Kybernetiko Symvoulio, which was something that a number of prime ministers have used extensively in driving policy in Greece. Karamanlis the senior, and Mitsotakis, and Simitis, and Karamanlis the junior, really engaged with that. That was a smaller group of ministers that was meeting as often as once a week, and it was the kind of the engine of the government during that time. For Papandreou, the senior in the 80s and the 90s, this formation did not really work. It was set up for it to work in the 80s, but it was never actually put into place. But the interesting, yet a bit boring, story to be told here is what happens with the less senior government committees where in other parts of Europe perform the daily sort of bread and butter function of the government. And here we see that this kind of sub-cabinet committees never really became an important feature of Greek government, with the exception perhaps of Karamanlis the senior with the economic committee back then and the Epitropi Timon and Isodimaton, and during Simitis' tenure with, again, the Economic and Social Committee and probably the Committee for Institutions, never really do we see a pattern of regular meetings across the width of the government's activity. And that's a huge problem because without that, there is no sort of backbone to the government's operation that could deliver policies that particularly when it involves more than one minister or more than one ministry, which is always a huge confusion about signatures and competences and so on and so forth. So the story of the less glamorous committees in the Greek government is a very interesting one, and one that is also relevant to what's going on today, I would argue, where the government is asked to deliver a huge range of reforms across different ministries, but there is no way of getting them organized because there is no structure there. So that's a huge problem. And now go to a little bit to the government bureaucracy. I won't get you bogged down in individual names and so on, but what we did here was to try and look at three key indicators. First, what is the size of the bureaucracy at the core of the government? What is the independence of it, in a way, whether it is able to exert some sort of preferences that are dissimilar or slightly dissimilar to that of their political masters, and also its influence in the policy making. And the story here is this, that in 1974, when Karamanlis first set up the whole system, the government bureaucracy was only 16 people. And since then, it has increased to 57, not really a huge number by any stretch of the imagination. And the influence of this committee, of this bureaucracy, has been, on average, very low, with two exceptions. Probably the premiership of Mitsotakis, where Evangelos Voloudakis became an important figure in the government. Certainly, the premiership of Kostas Simitis, with Socrates Kosmidis becoming a very powerful figure in the running of the government. You can make that argument about the last Samaras premiership, where Baltakos was also a figure that exercised a lot of power. But when it comes to independence, throughout that period, the independence of the government bureaucracy is zero. Why? Because there is no permanent civil servants staffing the core executive. All of them are handpicked. They're all political appointees. The head is a political appointee. Every single employee within it is a political appointee. What that means, going back to what Kevin was saying, is that they arrive on the day that the prime minister is appointed to a job that they have no clue how it all works, and they go when the prime minister resigns. So in terms of continuity having someone there to tell you what to do when you're given the keys of Maximo, there is nobody there. There is no structure. It's all change every time that the prime ministers come and go. Finally, on the issue of the prime minister's office, what we looked here, and that was also a very daunting task in trying to figure out the human geography of the prime minister's office, we looked first at the number of positions designated for these posts in official legal documents, then try and figure out how many of these positions were actually filled, and of course trying to ascertain the influence of the prime minister's office during the individual premierships. And here the picture is a very interesting one, because when Konstantinos Karamanlis created the prime minister's office, effectively what he had was five advisers and five secretaries. And since then, the prime minister's office membership has increased to now include 161, to provide for 161 positions. If you look at the actual appointments that were made during the different period, Initially, Karamanlis filled, as I said before, 10 of the 22 positions provided. Karamanlis, the junior, appointed 88 members in his office from the 160 that was provided. But if you look at the influence of the office during the different tenures, what you get here is a very diverse picture. The office under Andreas Papandreou expanded significantly. Papandreou wanted to create some sort of a White House in the Greek in the Greek context. But subsequently, particularly after 1987, the strength of the office decreased quite substantially, and it was quite low, really, even during his third premiership. On the opposite, Simitis activated his office to a great extent. It was by far the most powerful prime minister's office during that period. And despite having a comparable number of appointments in the office, Karamanlis chose not to activate it. So Karamanlis had very little to do, Karamanlis the junior, with his office. There were loads of people there, but Karamanlis did not engage them. Mitsotakis had a huge office too. He had the largest prime minister's office from all the different prime ministers. But there again too, his office in terms of influence was rather peripheral. Certainly more peripheral than that of Simitis. Certainly more peripheral than that of Andreas Papandreou in the early part of the 1980s. I'll make some concluding comments very quickly, because I don't want to take too much of your time. The first thing to say is that, of course, always the nodality and the functionality of the government is both the result of different individual leadership styles, but also the cultural baggage that Kevin talked about that often frame these styles and sort of shape these policy options, for sure. What is interesting is that the kind of Spartan core executive setup that was created by Karamanlis immediately after the transition to democracy really premised itself on the on heroic leadership and on trust. Probably the experience of Karamanlis's first years in power in the 1950s, but also the specificities of the early stages of the transition to democracy in the early 70s made him a lot more defensive, made him create a system that was very closed and relied to a very large extent on his own personal input. Now, the interesting thing from an analytical point of view is why has this system prevailed? And in the book we're trying to make these comments in more detail. In terms of the overall bureaucracy in the core executive, and by that I mean both the General Secretariat of the government and the Prime Minister's office, what we have here is certainly an expansion in terms of numbers, but a lot of confusion over functionality, competences, roles, and so on. The key problem here, in my mind, is a confusion of the advisory role that naturally the Prime Minister's office should provide to the Prime Minister, and the administrative role that in the Greek case nowadays is provided by political appointees who come and go at a very high pace, but not of a permanent administrative structure that can support this this function a lot better. Within this context, of course, coordination and oversight on behalf of the Prime Minister becomes very problematic, because if you don't have the staff, if you don't have the procedures to control the government machine, you might have a lot of powers to sack and appoint your ministers, but the minister always has the power of the detail. So the system is described often by lawyers as a prime ministerial system, but effectively, we argue, the system is a ministerial one. And that's why you very often see a lot of corruption scandals and so on associated at the level of the ministries, and perhaps those around the ministers that operate in a way without oversight from the top or without any control from the bureaucracy itself. A very important point that I think we all need to keep in mind here is the hugely problematic way in which the government drafts legislation, right? In recent months, and during the election campaign, a lot of fuss was made about the fact that the government had to import laws ready-made by the Troika and send them to the parliament for approval. And that, rightly so, was seen by many as very problematic for Greek democracy, for sovereignty, and all that kind of stuff. What not many people know is that the law initiation or the legal initiative function of the government is the best example in Greece of a public-private partnership. Because very, very rarely do draft bills in Greece are prepared by the administration. They are often subcontracted or given to law firms and so on, who apparently have the know-how to prepare them. That then goes back to the government, and the government then gets the draft bills into parliament. So that is hugely problematic, and it is a problem that feeds into this issue of polynomy. The government cannot deal with the fact that there were so many different laws. They cannot figure it out. They can legislate on the fact on that basis, but at the same time, it refuses to create permanent structures that will help deal with this problem and make its own functioning a lot more efficient. And it is for this reason, really, that we argue in the book that what you have here is effectively an illusion of power. A prime minister who is sitting in Maximou can do or can project unlimited power, often quoting the constitution and so on. But when it comes to the nitty-gritty, when it comes to the running of the government, this is really an emperor without clothes. So I'll pass on to Kevin for some concluding remarks.
I'm going to...
In the interest of time, I'm going to skip quite a lot, and some of the stuff may come out in the Q&A. I just wanted to perhaps make three points. The arrival of the Troika, of course, presented the established system, this embedded system, with its nemesis. One of the things that the Troika has done, in minute detail, is to specify some of the organizational changes required of Greek governance. Indeed, if we look at the memoranda for Greece, we've calculated something like 40% of all of the reforms required of Greece refer to changes in public administration. So the diagnosis we've got here of the dysfunctionalities of coordination, control, the efficiency of government, that diagnosis has been shared largely by the Troika and by external consultants. The OECD did a major study of Greek government in 2011. Now, the Troika has led to the Greek government instituting some changes at the top. So the short-lived Papademos government, the technocratically headed government, agreed to create what was called a Directorate of Planning, Management, and the Monitoring of Reforms. More recently, the Samaras government established a new General Secretariat for the Coordination of the Government as a direct result of the insistence of the Troika. I am not about to suggest that the Troika mechanism was one which was in any sense unproblematic. But what we are saying is that it has taken external intervention to change, to shift, to try to reform the problem of the coordination of governments. And why did Greece need the Troika to shift this pattern, this pathology that we've outlined here? I think the answer to that is very much with the kind of factors and conditions that we've outlined. The organizational fragmentation, the cultural mindsets and attitudes that we've displayed. So yes, there's been changes, and the Mitrus's set of cases indicated some degree of variation across the prime ministerships. But it sounds cliched, but I guess what we're saying is that the more things changed over time, the more things actually stayed the same. So thanks very much, and we look forward to Ed's comments.
Thanks very much for that. I'm going to make a few comments. I was asked to talk for 10 minutes. I'll try and cut it down to four or five. And then I think we'll, instead of answering
points,
go straight to the questions from the audience. I think that this goes without saying, this book is a very important piece of work. It offers a range of different styles of running the centre of government. The fact that there are different styles in running the centre of government is hardly specific to Greece. Cameron isn't Gordon Brown. There are very different approaches towards the management of prime ministership. I think that what the book shows, however, is that some of the basic institutions and assumptions about how these central government core executive functions work vary probably in a way that goes beyond just style of how prime ministers use the tools, but rather the tools themselves seem to be weaker than you'd expect anywhere else and more subject to change. And we have a series of five chapters which go through how different prime ministers use them. I won't try and summarize them. I think this analysis has got fairly important implications for the management of austerity. They were touched on at the end by Kevin, and I'm sure that some of the questions will come out about that. And it's a very powerful and compelling analysis about the heart of the Greek state. As a discussant, I have to find something to take issue with. And without being a Greek expert, and that will probably be apparent in the questions that I'm going to pose, my comments are sort of more or less along comparative lines. And I'm sort of hesitant here because this is part of the analysis exceptionally well covered in the introductory two chapters and in the last two chapters. So I'm hoping that I can still raise a couple of more general points. I think underpinning the whole analysis is the contrast between a bureaucratic, routinized style of running the prime ministerial machine, broadly conceived, and the various ways in which the different prime ministers deviated from this, above all by relying on personal trust and networks. And this basic point leads me to three questions. Firstly, I wonder if there's really such a contrast between these two different phenomena, and whether the bureaucratic, routinized style actually requires the personalized networks. If you look at something like the German Bundeskanzleramt, I wonder whether it really governs that impersonally. If you look at the organogram, it's very clear that there are different Referate, which are concerned with different ministries, and there's a Geschäftsordnung, which says how things should be handled and so on and so forth. But the studies that I've seen of the Bundeskanzleramt, admittedly some of them rather dated, tend to suggest that it's the personal networks that are created within the Bundeskanzleramt that actually make it work. Helmut Schmidt was sort of the centralizer who developed close contracts with the machine, while Kohl seemed, at least early on, too keen to delegate to ministers and turned his back on the whole machine. There's a sort of second related point that there might be a bit of a danger in exaggerating Greek distinctiveness in this respect. Despite the formal machinery of delivery units and policy units of the Blair year, the idea that government was actually run by this coordinating machinery would be to overplay the point. I was struck in the discussion of Kostas Simitis, who came closest to achieving this Weberian idea of a bureaucratic machine at the heart of government. But actually the reality turned out a sort of more personal style of governing, as I understand it, in that chapter. Now, critics of the Bear style were that it was also highly personal government, despite all of these attempts to try to join up government. And the power of the prime minister was felt not necessarily through the coordinating mechanisms, but in the areas of government that Blair actually was personally interested in and threw his weight behind. And I think even more striking similarity with Greece might come from France, where Jack Hayward and Vincent Wright study. And I was interested that you pointed to Napoleonic efficiency. I think they would certainly take issue with that. where behind the sort of Cartesian framework of coordination, you have this basically anarchic practice of political networks, patronage, bargaining, and all the rest of it. And I wonder if that's... my final point is a simple question. And that is, are the coordinating mechanisms all they're cracked up to be? What are the real benefits? Let me put this in a more basic question and relating to what you were talking about at the end. If we take the challenge of introducing the radical policy changes that need to be made to meet the bailout requirements and the sort of thing that was outlined in the budget, I think, just the other day, you could at least put the argument that this isn't likely to require the coordination across the whole of government, but some sort of prime ministerial street fighting. This is not a question of coordination. It's a matter of applying your political force to make sure in a relatively large number, but still a limit, it's not across the whole of government, but fighting. So those would be my observations. And I think I've tried to keep within 5 minutes.
Thank you very much.